Emin, wake up. Come on. What's wrong with you? What's wrong with you, Emin? Emin, let's get with it. You're always late. You're just another pretty face. I'm really tired of you. You're fired.
That's Donald Trump appearing in a 2013 music video. The singer is Azerbaijani pop star Emin Agalarov. Well, it turns out Emin Agalarov is now a figure in that meeting we found out about over the weekend between Donald Trump Jr. and a Russian attorney. She apparently offered Trump Jr. damaging information on Hillary Clinton's campaign. Here to update us on this developing story is Yohi Drizin, foreign editor at Vox. Hello there.
Hi, nice to be with you.
All right, let's see if we can fit all these pieces of this puzzle, this expanding puzzle, together. What is this pop star doing in this story of the meeting between Donald Trump Jr., Jared Kushner, Paul Manafort, and this Russian lawyer?
This whole story just almost literally could not get stranger. You've got pop stars and lawyers and adoptions and sanctions. And I mean, the step back is really what's at issue here is a question of collusion, whether this is the first real sign possibly of the Trump campaign colluding with Moscow. But Emin Agalarov is interesting. He's a pop star. I was listening just a moment ago to some of his stuff on YouTube, which is much better than I would have thought. And he's interesting because it's his agent who sort of set up this meeting between Donald Trump Jr. and the lawyer in question, Natalia Vetselskaya. But Emin Agalarov, it's a mouthful, his father actually is in some ways the more interesting figure here, because his father is a real estate developer, very, very wealthy, who had, among other things, brought the Miss Universe pageant that Donald Trump had sponsored to Moscow in 2013, and was also working on a Trump Tower project in Moscow as well. So you have the son, who's the pop star, his agent helped set up the meeting, but the person kind of lurking behind this, the one who's in many ways more interesting, is the father, because the father, we know, has very close connections to Donald Trump. And we know he has very close connections to Vladimir Putin.
And the father is Aras Agalarov. And he's a real estate developer. He's a billionaire from Azerbaijan, right?
That's right. And he is also someone who's mentioned by name in the dossier that had been compiled by Christopher Steele. So it's interesting that people who are dynamics and people who are in that dossier, which had been so widely discredited or attempted by the White House to discredit it when it first was released, you're now seeing bits and pieces get substantiated.
Okay, so it's a lot of threads being knitted together. And what do we know so far, though, about whether or not there could or it's likely at all that there was any collusion whatsoever so far?
Right, so it's a lot of threads and it's a lot of very difficult to pronounce names. So I hope people listening will forgive me if I stumble over some of them. But what's interesting about this is, to me, is the way that Donald Trump Jr.'s defenses have shifted. First, he said that it had to do with trying to make it easier for Americans to adopt Russian children and possibly lifting some of the sanctions that have been imposed on Russia some years back under what's called the Magnitsky Act. Then that shifted to him more openly saying, no, it was because she said she had some damaging information about Hillary Clinton and I wanted to meet with her to see if she did. And that's really, it's that second part that really gets to the heart of why this may be a potential criminal violation by Donald Trump Jr. People, when they think about foreign interference in an American election or foreign involvement, think that that has to do just with money, that it's illegal, let's say, for a foreign government, a foreign citizen, to fund an American campaign, which makes logical sense. But financial assistance isn't the only type of assistance that is potentially criminal. Any kind of direct involvement in an American election by a foreign national or a foreign government is very likely illegal. So if Donald Trump Jr. went to this meeting thinking he would get useful information that might help his father in a presidential election, that itself is very likely a criminal violation.
Although he says that the information was unreliable and that it didn't make sense what she was saying, and they quickly moved off that topic.
Right. Although intent is what really matters. In some ways, it's less whether he actually got what he thought he was going to get so much as what he hoped he might get. And the defense, in some ways, to my mind, digs the hole deeper, because what he's basically saying is, if she had better stuff, then I would have happily stayed there and sponged up of it, as much of it as I could. Mm-hmm. So it's one of those cases, I think, where the attempt of the defense in many ways digs the hole deeper.
And now he has said that his father knew nothing about this meeting.
Right. And that's, frankly, up until now, even people who have so far been the most critical of the White House and the ones who have most thought there is something genuinely fishy going on between the Trump campaign and the Kremlin. So far, that has not gotten to Donald Trump. And it's important, I think, to remember that it's very possible his campaign did dirty, shady, possibly illegal things that he was not directly involved in. It's, of course, possible that he was directly involved in it. But even the investigation so far into the Trump campaign's possible collusion with Russia, they focus on the campaign, not on him. He's now being investigated more for the obstruction of justice side, having to do with his firing of Jim Comey. Mm-hmm. But the collusion piece, which is where this would fit under, that's Jared Kushner, that's Paul Manafort, that's Roger Stone, it's Mike Flynn, it's Trump campaign aides as compared to Trump himself.
Okay, so getting back to the Agalarovs and the fact that this meeting was set up by the manager of Agalarov, the singer, Emin, is that right?
That's right. It's his publicist, Rob Goldstone.
So I guess what's confusing is, what is the connection then between this lawyer and Agalarov?
I think that's where it sort of comes back ultimately to, as everything does with Russia, back to Vladimir Putin. The lawyer is somebody who is married to someone who had been in Vladimir Putin's government. She's widely seen as, if not a paid agent of the Kremlin, not in a spying sense, but if not a paid lobbyist for the Kremlin, basically someone who speaks for it. The elder Agalarov, the father, is similarly in that very tight circle of Putin friends, Putin cronies, and that's sort of where it begins to link up. You know, the son is interesting because it's so bizarre and colorful. You've got this pop star sort of in the middle of all this, but he in some ways is irrelevant. The much more relevant person is the lawyer and the father, because they're knitted together through Vladimir Putin. They have professional dealings. They've got, in the case of the father, financial dealings. And so as we're trying to kind of keep all of this clear in our minds, which is legitimately really hard, the son is the colorful figure. The publicist was the literal way that this was set up. But the much more important figure is the father.
Mm. And Donald Trump Sr., the president of the United States, he wanted to build some kind of hotel, right, in Azerbaijan, in Baku, where the Agalarovs are from.
That's right. And it's Azerbaijan is one of the most corrupt countries on the face of the planet. And that deal, which has been held up for quite some time, has been for a long time held up as an example of Donald Trump doing business with very, very shady people. I mean, this is not building a hotel in Europe, or even for that matter, building a hotel in parts of the Middle East, like Dubai. This is building a hotel in a very corrupt petrostate run by wealthy cronies, wealthy allies of Vladimir Putin. And so this deal has been under some fire and sort of in crosshairs of people looking at Donald Trump critically for quite some time.
And it should be noted, the president of Azerbaijan is the father-in-law of this singer, Emin.
That's right. That's right.
So it's just like very close-knit.
Right. I mean, you just see the connections of, you know, a billionaire who is both a Russian Azerbaijani, who has power and connections to both the government of Russia and all that they may have been trying to do to help Donald Trump, the government of Azerbaijan and all it may have been trying to do to bring Donald Trump and his hotel into Azerbaijan. It's just an extraordinary, just circular thing where the circles just get tighter and tighter and tighter. And at the end of the day, you have this question of Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin. Was there something between them? And if not, was there something between Donald Trump's closest allies and Vladimir Putin's closest allies? And that's what's seeming more and more likely. And it's frankly very disturbing, because that begins to get to possible criminal collusion.
All right. Well, thank you, Yohei, for clearing some of that up.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Yohei Driesen is foreign editor at Vox. While we're all talking about the 2016 election and Russian meddling in that, state election officials are already worried about the next election, 2018, and whether or not Russia will meddle in that. U.S. secretaries of state gathered in Indianapolis over the weekend for their annual meeting, and some of them said they are afraid better security measures will not be in place before the midterms. U.S. intelligence officials say Russia may have directed hackers to break into the election systems of nearly two dozen states last year. Russia also probably hacked one company that provides voting registration software to eight states. Here to talk about this is Loyola Law School professor Jessica Levinson, who joins us each and every Monday. Hello.
For more happy, not at all scary news.
Exactly. Exactly. So what are they worried about, these secretaries of state?
They're worried about, I think, two main things. One is the psychological fears that people have. Once they hear that their information is hacked, then are they going to be less likely to do what a lot of secretaries of state want them to do, which is register to vote and actually vote. So we've already heard some reports of people saying Russians hacked into my information. You know what? I think I'm just going to not register to vote, or I'm not going to update my registration, or I don't want to be part of this process. So that in and of itself is actually suppressing the vote. And then what they're also worried about is being able to control their own information. So we basically have, as citizens, a contract with our Secretary of State, which is, yes, I will give you this information and you will keep it safe and you will not allow it to be infiltrated by foreign governments. And as a result, I will be able to go to my polling place or get my ballot in the mail and cast a vote and you will count it. And this will all be perfectly safe and there will be a high level of integrity.
And also that my vote won't be changed.
And that, so that absolutely, and I think it's important to look at different buckets that we're thinking about. So people say really broadly, Russians hacked the election. Now, American intelligence agencies all tell us that Russians did break into email systems to try and sway our votes, to try and change our decisions. That's different from going into voter registration information, which it also looked like they tried to do, which is also different from changing votes.
Right.
So I want it to be
so there are three
really
separate things we're talking about.
Yeah.
And there's no information that they actually were able to do the last two things.
Exactly. There's some information about breaches of voter registration information, which I think we're still finding out about. There's no credible information I've seen that votes were changed. The kind of made for TV drama of there's a chip in the voting machine and someone steals it. So that remains that there is no information on this vote changing, actually hacking votes.
So the secretaries of state, though, they are worried about what for the 2018 elections?
So they're worried that there will be continued security breaches. Now, our voting information and our voting machines tend to be updated, you know, every like 55 years. I mean, so because voting is one of these things, except for this insane election cycle that never stops and the story of Russian hacking, it tends to be something that people really care about their voting machines for about, you know, 45 seconds before they walk into their voting machine. Mm-hmm. And so there isn't a lot of federal funding to do what we need to do, which is update. Like a lot of our voting machines are kind of the equivalent of dot matrix printers.
But in a certain sense, maybe that's more secure because they're not hackable. A piece of paper isn't necessarily hackable.
Well, and that's what some people are actually saying, you know, maybe we should pull back. And so while we don't vote online, maybe we should actually pull back and take all of this information off of line. I don't think a lot of secretaries of state are going to do that. And I think it's important for people to know more broadly, this discussion in and of itself, I think, will harm voter turnout, which will harm Democrats, because the more we talk about fears of registering to vote or how you vote, or maybe you vote on paper, it means at the very least we're not expanding your ability to vote. And we know that young people will vote more if they can do it on their phone. And sadly, the conversation is pulling so far away from that.
Okay. Meanwhile, the Trump administration has convened this bipartisan commission to apparently look into voter fraud. And they've asked for all sorts of information from secretaries of state in various states. 40 states have said no. We're not going to do this.
Right.
Or more than 40, actually.
More than 40 states have said no. And some states have said, well, we might provide you with some of this information or we're undecided. And I think there's a couple of things to think about. One is this is a Republican conservative administration who's saying to states and localities, we want to centralize information. This is ironic in and of itself because Republicans and conservatives tend to say we need more local control. That's the opposite of what we're doing here. We're trying to bring more federal control. It's also really important to remember that these claims of widespread voter fraud or widespread voter impersonation or undocumented workers voting at the polls simply has no credible evidence. So the purported purpose of this commission is really based on, it's not even based on a house of cards. I mean, it really is that there's no basis for this information.
Why do you think they want this information?
I think they want this information for the reason that they have been trying to pass voting laws for years, if not decades, which is frankly, it's a cover for trying to suppress votes. I'm sure it will shock all of your listeners to know that this is an imperfect system. So once you start looking at information like where people live and whether or not they're registered and whether they're citizens and whether or not they're dead, for instance, you will find some problems. And so you will find that there are bloated voter rolls, that people in states have either died or moved away. And so my guess is that this commission will write a report that looks something like, well, we haven't found actual voter fraud. You need to look at all of these really scary things. And those scary things show you that there's a great potential for fraud. And therefore, we need these stringent rules.
Always a ray of sunshine, Jessica Levinson, law professor at Loyola Law School. Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up on the program, the Netflix series Black Mirror makes technology in the near future look terrifying. But creator Charlie Brooker says technology isn't the problem. It's how we're adapting to it.
It's a bit like we've grown an extra limb or a new tail or something like that. And we're at the moment flailing around and knocking things off the shelves.
Charlie Brooker of Black Mirror next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Emmy nominations will be announced on Thursday, and the critically acclaimed Netflix series Black Mirror has a chance of snagging a few. Black Mirror is kind of like The Twilight Zone, but set in the near future. It's about the black mirrors in our lives, you know, those screens we're addicted to. It was submitted for consideration in the TV movie category. I spoke recently with the executive producers of Black Mirror, Charlie Brooker and Annabelle Jones. Charlie Brooker told me that despite the dark and twisted tone of Black Mirror, he is not trying to scare people away from technology. In fact, he's a former video game critic who loves technology. He just thinks that humans are still trying to figure out how to harness the power of it properly for the good of humankind.
I hope that what's going on at the moment in the world is a consequence of us learning how to use that power. And it is a power. So it's a bit like we've grown an extra limb or a new tail or something like that. And we're at the moment flailing around and knocking things off the shelves.
And we can't cut off the limb.
You can't. Well, what are you going to do? How are you going to do that? How are you going to want to invent social media? How are you going to want to invent computers? That would be madness.
And why would you want to?
Why would you not want
a computer?
You'd need to use a computer to work out how to do it. and then you'd be stuck in a logical spiral from which there is no escape. So you can't uninvent these things, and nor should you uninvent these things. It's just we are having to adapt to a change in our abilities, really. And the problem is that we are basically idiots. So we're having to learn how to, well, we're clumsy, you know, we're having to learn how to use these new powers we've got. Kind of like the opening act of a Superman movie.
Got it. Mm. Do you find, because your series debuted in England, and now that it's gone big, it's on Netflix and it's here in the United States, that you've had to calibrate your sense of humor and how you're writing?
I don't think so.
No, I was just interested. I was just thinking, would we have done the pig one?
That's the most polarizing
one.
Yeah.
The National Anthem,
I don't know what I can say about it, but like just in terms of there is an unusual ransom.
Prime Minister Michael Callaghan, my life.
A princess is kidnapped.
My life depends on you.
And the Prime Minister of England is told that the ransom demand is that the Prime Minister must go on television
Live
and have full sexual intercourse with a pig.
This afternoon.
It was a shocking opening.
Yes.
It was a bit of a statement of intent, like this show is not like the other shows.
Episode one, season one.
And it was interesting in that I think partly because in the UK, I'm known for coming from the world of comedy, and I present comedy shows and stuff like that, and I've done written comedy shows. So I think people maybe had a slightly different perspective on it and would see the dark humour in it possibly more. That's one thing that maybe translates differently over here, and it becomes a very polarising episode, I notice, over here. So we generally recommend that people start with a different episode over here.
Farmers over here love it and non-farmers don't.
Farmers love it. Animal lovers love it.
The PETA people love it.
Yeah. It's
Yeah, so we might not have done that one.
Yeah.
That was the only... Yeah.
It's certainly... If you can get through that and you go, okay, I'm in... Then
that's the wrong expression.
That's the wrong expression to use.
Yeah.
But you can. Then you're not going to go anywhere. We hopefully will have you for the rest of the run. But that's the one that I hear the most, that people say, well, I tried watching it and there was this prime minister and a pig and I thought, I am never watching that again. And then like a year later, somebody recommended this show to me and I watched the Nosedive or San Junipero and I didn't think it was the same show and I enjoyed it. And so
I love it when people watch National Anthem and then they say, no, it's not for me, that one. And it is for some other people.
That's just a British way of saying this is the worst.
It is for some people. I think maybe we just have a different...
I loved it. Yeah. People don't often say that.
I've really got a very soft spot for the National Anthem. I really love the National Anthem and I kind of feel like...
But it does feel like you're taking the viewer by the lapels and slapping them across the face.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah.
With what?
Annabelle agrees with me.
Because it's like, I mean, when we had the very first screening that we did for that episode, we got the exact reaction we wanted, which was that when the ransom demand is made, the audience, and it was these were all journalists, all sort of, they couldn't believe it. And they was like, and laughing. And then the laughter died in their throats throughout the rest of the hour until by the end you're extremely... you're sympathizing very much with the Prime Minister and you realize this is not just, it's not funny that it's happening to a human being. It's an awful, awful, sickening thing. It's meant to make you feel sick.
Talk a little bit about how you went from this British phenomenon to now this larger American thing on Netflix.
Me personally.
The
show.
The show. The show.
Yeah.
And what that meant for the show.
Yes, so we thought it was going to be a very British show. We thought the tone and the sensibility, maybe influenced by the National Anthem, was very local. And so we were very surprised when it seemed to travel, I think is the word, the term, and lots of countries around the world started, you know, picking it up and really enjoying it. And so we thought, wow, okay, who'd have thought technology existed all over the world? who'd have thought outside of London? And as a result, Netflix then picked it up. And I think it was 2 years before it got to America. I think that's
right. Yeah, I was really impatient waiting for it to show.
Because it's a small run. You know, none of the conventional networks, linear broadcasters, were going to pick it up because it was hard to schedule. And then Netflix came along and said, we would love to take this. And you go, that would be wonderful. And then they took the first two seasons and it did really well for them. And then they approached us to do a, you know, to do a show for them. So we were very lucky. And we have, and they've liked it and we're doing more. But I don't think creatively it's changed the position of the show. I think maybe it's allowed us to be slightly more ambitious, to, you know, a bigger canvas. Has allowed us to do maybe... not just purely British set stories. So it would have been odd if we were in the just for a British audience to have something set in California, say, for example. But now we can have that option because we're, you know, the show is for the world.
And so with Nosedive, the episode with Bryce Dallas Howard, where it's all about getting your likes up and getting people to approve of you online.
Yeah. You've seen the guest list. They are all like 4.5 or above. They are going to freak at a 2.6. And I am not taking that kind of damage. Plus, I haven't dipped under a 4.7 in like 6 months.
That is set in Florida, right?
We don't
or a Florida-esque type community.
We never quite say. It was actually shot in South Africa.
But
we never quite say where it is. It's a sort of slightly Truman Show-esque kind of Pleasantville-esque.
Right. I guess that's why I assume Florida.
I've never been to Florida. Is it a pastel nightmare full of people judging each other?
I don't know about the judging part.
I've described there.
Yeah, exactly. The pastel, yes. I'm not sure about the judging.
I mean, often these places aren't a specific location, which is again one of the reasons why we can often sort of take a story and set it It just where it feels right, but they can kind of travel quite easily. In that, mm-hmm. there was nothing specifically.
But that sort of sunny optimism, yes. that yes. she just seems so American. It just seems, something that I think this unkindly, but something that you don't necessarily associate with a Brit.
No, because we're miserable. That's true.
Well,
we are.
You said it.
Well, yeah, because we live on a rainy hellhole that just voted to hack itself away from the only sophisticated neighbours we're ever going to have. So, of course, we're depressed. you know, like, of course we are. We're all crying. But I think that was partly the story. It made sense to give it this kind of slightly eerie caricature of an American sort of way of life, I suppose. I mean, yeah, something that Joe Wright, who directed it, sort of brought to it, was quite keen to bring to it, I think.
Really?
Yes, but we had thought this should be set in America, mm-hmm. in terms of everyone aspires to live in, you know, warmer climates and live in a sort of constantly optimistic world. So
it's an Instagram world, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, it's Instagram, yeah. Mm. It's
Is that not something you recognize in Britain? I mean, it is. Yeah. It's the same thing in Britain, right?
Oh, the same. I mean, we have the same sort of
Instagram
horrible
world
cloying
and
rat
the,
race and, the,
and yeah. the liking and all that.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that must be universal now, which is why I think people can seem to relate to that episode again on a fairly universal level. It's just when we do it, we're doing it against drab skies and horrible urine-streaked pavements.
I don't know what London you're living in. I think we live in different Londons.
Open your eyes! My God, have you seen? Look at the sky and look at the sidewalk. Sorry, sidewalk is the phrase.
Pavement,
urine
whatever.
Street
pavement,
sidewalks. Yeah, that's what London is.
You can't talk about the fourth season, I assume.
Not really, except we can say that it's underway and it's very different again. I mean, that's really all we can say about it, is it?
Jodie Foster is directing an episode.
Jodie Foster has directed an episode. That's good, isn't it?
That's very exciting.
She's very nice as well. It's like terrifying.
How was it working
with
her?
Well, it was
easy.
She's really, like, I would say the thing that I was struck by above and beyond anything else was that she's really nice and she seems really normal. For someone who's like, do you know what I mean? Who's grown
up. Grew up in Hollywood.
Like, yeah. Exactly. I mean, crazy life, you know? And just very down to earth, very normal. Like you could just talk to her normally
through her people. Yeah.
And every so often, like we'd go into the edit and stuff like that. And every so often, I'd suddenly get a vertigo moment, and I'd go, oh, "It's Jodie Foster. She was in Taxi Driver, you know, or something like that." She had Silence of the Lambs.
Yeah, so like, it's quite unsettling when you did that to her.
And I think I managed to not act like a lunatic around her.
But how much control do you have over these episodes? You write them all, I assume.
Yeah. Well, there's co-writers as well. Sometimes, I mean, there's like we've worked with other writers as well on some of the episodes, but I write most of them. Mm-hmm. And then we go into every corner of the show. Sorry, that sounds a little bit weird. But we
it's showrunner, the American term.
Showrunner.
So we're showrunners. So we cast and choose the director and the director of photography and editor and, you know, we're in collaboration with the director, but we form the teams, the crew together then that goes and make the individual films.
We sort of sign off on everything.
Yes.
I mean, the directors have a lot more leeway on our show than they would on a serialized show because we want each one to look idiosyncratic and have its own flavor and tone, and so it becomes it's a creative process where I'll have written the script, we've discussed the script, we go through it, and then when we get a director on board, there'll be another conversation. Sometimes the tone of it will go in a direction we hadn't necessarily foreseen, but we'll be in agreement on that all the time. But we sign off on everything down to the typefaces.
Oh yes, we're ridiculously
get really
hands
anal
on.
About all
really?
Of that. Oh yes. God, I love it. We hide little Easter eggs in there and stuff for people who are pressing pause. Insults for people who press pause.
Really?
Oh yeah.
So you don't want anyone to stop, go to the kitchen, get something to eat, and come back.
No, I hate those people. What? No, of course, no. It's a fun. It's fun to hide things.
Yeah.
The Easter eggs concept is fun to hide.
And
things
you have things that go from episode to episode, even though they are discrete episodes.
Yes, they're all standalone. But
yes, occasionally, sometimes cross-referenced, but
the Easter
not
eggs.
Yes, but not thematically or story wise.
No. Although we have... No, I can't say anything.
No.
What, is this in the fourth?
I'm not even saying that. Okay. I didn't even pull a facial expression.
You didn't even say that. Charlie Brooker, creator and writer of Black Mirror, Annabelle Jones, executive producer of Black Mirror. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, one Muslim recruit's experience in the Marine Corps' basic training raises a lot of red flags.
First, they march him into the showers to get him wet and make him, like, do exercises. Then they put him in the clothes dryer and would run the dryer and then open it and ask him a question.
An investigation into hazing in the Marines next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Marine Corps recruitment used to be all about selling the idea of being an elite fighter, a warrior, a hero. The new recruitment strategy is a bit different.
They say ours is the entitled generation. The me first, first to quit, still in bed at 10 generation. Thin-skinned, thick-headed. We've got no medal because we expect a medal just for showing up. It's not my place to say they're wrong. It's my time.
Okay, squarely aimed at the millennials, recruiters need young people of all races and income levels these days, especially those on track for college, many of whom are struggling with debt. Debt the Marines promise to help with. And that's how Raheel Siddiqui, a 20-year-old engineering student from Michigan, ended up at boot camp on Parris Island in South Carolina. Less than 2 weeks into his basic training, Raheel died, officially of suicide. Journalist Janet Reitman is a contributing editor at Rolling Stone, and her latest piece is for the New York Times Magazine. It was over the weekend. It was the cover story, and it's called How the Death of a Muslim Recruit Revealed a Culture of Brutality in the Marines. Hi, Janet.
Hi.
Well, first, tell us about Raheel Siddiqui. He was from a small town near Detroit. He was a great student on track to do very, very well in college. Tell us more about him and why he decided to join the Marines.
Yeah, Raheel was a young man who grew up outside of Detroit, and he was like an AP student who went through school, high school, and, you know, with the same group of friends, studying intently, determined to become an engineer and to better his life and to better his family's life and to basically, you know, take his family out of the situation they were in. They were living in public housing. His father was working in a factory, making like, you know, about probably a few hundred dollars a week. Mm-hmm. The mom had worked, you know, various jobs, but actually when he was 18 and he finished high school, he told his mom, as the sort of the eldest son, the only son in this kind of relatively conservative Pakistani-American family, that he was going to take care of things and he was going to help contribute and that she didn't need to work so hard any longer. So he finishes high school. He's a valedictorian. And he goes to college. He gets a scholarship, partial scholarship, to the University of Michigan at Dearborn. His second semester, like finishing his freshman year, he did extremely well. But he all of a sudden announced to his family that summer that he was going to drop out of college and he was going to join the Marine Corps.
So he joins up and he goes to Parris Island, which is one of the major places where Marine recruits go for basic training, for boot camp. Right. And the Marine boot camp is particularly arduous compared to the other branches of the military. They really believe in creating this culture of, I guess, a warrior, a cohesive unit, but through very, I don't know, some of the techniques you describe could be described as torture.
Well, the Marines have two main recruiting what they call depots, or two places that if you want to enlist in the Marine Corps, not be an officer, just enlist, you can go. You will go to either Paris Island, or if you live west of the Mississippi, you'll go to San Diego. Paris Island has always had this sort of mystique. It's very removed. You can access it only by a bridge. It's off the coast of South Carolina. It's very swampy and hot. And it's always been sort of, you know, mythologized as a place for suffering. Mm-hmm. And marine lore and marine unity, in a sense, is, and the bonds, this sort of unspoken bond between Marines, you know, relates on to some degree on their ability to withstand grueling physical experiences, suffering, pain. They play a lot of games with these kids. And, but the problem is what happens at night. And, you know, what the Marine Corps will say is it's against the rules for anything to happen at night. You know, recruits are guaranteed a certain amount of sleep. After lights out, they're supposed to be sleeping. And in this case, you know, you had everything from physical assaulting of kids to this kind of this unauthorized cleaning, where they'd be getting down on the floor with these brushes that each kid is assigned what they call a scuzz brush, just like a scrub brush, because they're responsible for cleaning the bunks, and they would have them, you know, wheeling each other around like wheelbarrows and cleaning the floor with this stuff, or, you know,
with bleach.
One kid, that one drill instructor a couple years ago was actually court-martialed for making his kids do unauthorized exercises with pure bleach. You know, pouring bleach in the shower so that they inhale this stuff. I mean, there was a lot of things that went on when there was no one in any form of authority except for the drill instructors.
You focus on one drill instructor. His name is Gunnery Sergeant Joseph Felix, and he seems to be particularly extreme. Describe one case with another Muslim recruit. His name, if I'm pronouncing it correctly, is Amir Bourmesh.
Right.
And describe what he did to him, because I think it does set up what happens later with Raheel.
So Amir Bourmesh is a Marine now. He's still in the Marines, and he comes from Brooklyn, New York. But he was absolutely determined to get through training, which he did, and he finishes, and they go through this arduous, grueling 54-hour final test that's called the Crucible. But there's a week before graduation, and during that week, these drill instructors on night duty, including Felix, they come into the bunk, to the barracks late at night. They walk up to this, you know, kid's bed, and they order him down. And they say things to him like, you know, what's your religion? You know, Islam. Are you a terrorist? No, sir. Are you a Muslim? Yes, sir. And then they march him into the laundry room, which is off the squad bay. First they march him into the showers to get him wet and make him, like, do exercises. Then they put him in the clothes dryer and would run the dryer and then open it and ask him a question. You know, did you do 9/11? Are you still a Muslim? You know, yes, sir. Close the door. Run the dryer again.
Oh, my gosh.
Still a Muslim? Yeah.
And so this is hot air on this.
Hot air, yeah, on this kid. And his shoulders are burned. He's beginning to cry. And, you know, the questions are going on. And they finally, like, open the door, let him out. And one of the drill instructors walks up to him and says, you know, that was pretty messed up when it just happened to you, but, you know, you're not going to tell anybody, right? Nope, I'm not going to tell anybody. So apparently the next night, this happened again. And this time, the same drill instructor comes over to him and orders him down off of his bed and this was even worse than the clothes dryer for some reason, but he tied a belt around his neck and they walked him around like a dog.
So this happened to one Marine, but this was relatively recent, but before Raheel Siddiqui came to the boot camp.
So this happened about 6 months before.
Do we know if similar things happened to him? Do we know what led to his suicide?
Raheel, we don't know as much, though. I was struck by, when I met the family, I saw some photographs they had taken of Raheel's body. And he had these like a ligature, what they call the ligature mark around his neck. He had like a, it looked like a rope burn around his neck. And the day before he died, he had been complaining that he couldn't, he had a terrible sore throat, he could barely speak, he couldn't swallow. He had been coughing up blood, and he asked to go to the medical office. But his drill instructor, Felix, was not pleased that Raheel couldn't speak. So he started to punish him, and he started to scream at him to run back and forth across the squad bay. So he was running back and forth across the squad bay, and all of a sudden he just dropped to the floor. And Felix, according to all these reports, kneeled over this kid and started shouting at him to get up, get up, get up. He didn't get up, and then he slapped him across the face as if he was trying to wake him up. But then he slapped him again, and it was super loud, and it sort of echoed across the squad bay. And this is a very chilling moment. These kids were all, it was after breakfast, they were cleaning their barracks, and all of a sudden Raheel sprung up and just bolted towards the double doors that would lead out to a balcony, and then his barracks were on the top floor. And he just made a beeline straight out and propelled himself over that balcony.
So we don't know if it was suicide.
We don't know.
So what has been the official reaction? Are they saying, oh, this gunnery sergeant Joseph Felix is just a bad apple, that in general our policies are good? Or are the Marines actually doing some soul searching and thinking, well, maybe we do need to change the way we train these recruits?
So, and officially they've said to me, we've changed everything, our policies are fine now. That's the official line. It's like, it was a few bad apples, but, you know, we are doubling down and making sure that all of our procedures are followed. I think unofficially, certainly because a lot of people spoke to me, off the record, unofficially, there is a great concern that the Marines are not adjusting to the realities of the 21st century, which is that war is now not quite as physical as it used to be. And that, you know, hazing has never been okay. Hazing has never been okay on the books. And there are lots and lots of people in the Marines who are absolutely are opposed to hazing. And so it's not, I would not want to leave you with the impression that this is just, you know, the Marine Corps as a whole, you know, is all about hazing. It happens. It's part of the culture. In some ways, it's part of the culture of violence, which is very much a part of the Marines. And so how do you change that? How do you change that and still be a Marine? I think that's what they're facing. They're confronting, you know, this. And I think this, hopefully this story will, and this case will, one reason we want to keep it in the public eye, I think, is so they do confront it, because, you know, we are evolving as a culture. And do we still need to be as physically violent as we were? I don't know. Is that still needed? You know, and if so, why? Those are kinds of the questions that I think the Marine Corps is going to have to ask itself when, you know, it hopefully takes a very hard look at how some very talented young people have been treated.
Janet Reitman, she's a journalist and contributing editor at Rolling Stone, and you can read her latest piece. It's in this Sunday's New York Times Magazine. It's the cover story, and it's called The Making and Breaking of Marines. Check it out online. Janet, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. The Badwater 135 is often called the world's toughest foot race, and for good reason. The ultramarathon begins tonight at the lowest point in the Western Hemisphere, Badwater Basin in Death Valley, some 280 feet below sea level. by the way. It's going to be about 110 degrees at 8 o'clock tonight when it begins. Then it's 135 miles through incredibly tough terrain over two mountain ranges before the race ends about halfway up Mount Whitney at 8,500 feet. Jimmy Dean Freeman is a two-time bad water finisher. And instead of being at the start of the race, he's here with me right now. Hello.
Excited to be here, Madeline. Thanks for having me.
You don't want to be there in Death Valley?
I do actually wish that I was there. My wife just had our second kid, so this year I've opted out.
There's an ultramarathon for you. Okay, so you've completed this race, what, twice?
Twice, 2010 and last summer, 2016.
And how long did it take you?
Well, the first time I did it in 2010 was a morning start. So it started at 6, 8, and 10 a.m. for three different waves. I finished it in 34 and a half hours, which was good for, I think, 16th overall.
34
and
hours?
34 and a half hours,
and
yeah.
And just the whole way through, you don't rest? You don't
stop? You're allowed to rest. That's part of your strategy as a team. The objective is to do it straight through with a few very minor breaks. Last year, I had considerable more trouble with those rest breaks. So it took me 38 and a half hours. And at one point, I left the course to go sleep and then return to the course and complete.
And how long
it.
Did you sleep?
An hour.
An hour.
Yeah.
So do you, when you're going through it, maybe at hour, I don't know, 20, 26 or whatever, do you start to hallucinate?
Oh, for sure. It's not a consistent thing. I think the hallucination bit is a random confluence of factors, which sleep deprivation is a major element of that. Uh-huh. And the new race, the new schedule with the evening start, 8 p.m., 9:30 p.m., and 11 p.m., I started in the 11 p.m. wave last year, and 3 hours in, I was struggling. So it really depends on the athlete and the amount of fatigue involved. I didn't actually hallucinate last year, but in night two, I was losing my vision. So as I was sort of staggering into the road, my pacer, one of my support team members, was kind of grabbing me by the neck and dragging me back to the white line. And at that point was where I decided to try and get some rest for a quick moment and get back on the course and continue forward.
Okay, this does not sound fun. Why do you do this?
Yeah, I mean, here's the thing. It's definitely an adventure. Mm-hmm. And there are elements of fun to it, and there are elements of outright misery. And I think that the community of people that finds this event attractive and events like this, we've learned that through suffering, you get to the other side of that, and you start to look at the world in a different way. And I think it's kind of a Buddhist tenet of through suffering comes enlightenment. You find moments of great joy, even in the fatigue and despair, if you will. And there's a lot of elements of it that are a lot of fun. The camaraderie of the community of people that do it, the support teams. You're competing against people, but not really against. It's kind of like a personal journey side by side with a bunch of other nutcases.
Well, you have to be invited to run this race.
You have to be invited, but you have to apply to be invited, and there are some minimum criteria to be met. You have to have run 3 100-mile continuous events to meet the minimum criteria, and they do like to see the athletes that have supported other competitors in years past. So if you go to Badwater and help another athlete, you have a lot more experience that will help you prepare for this type of event. So those two factors are big in their selection process.
But I understand they also ask character questions, such as, do people consider you a good person?
Yeah, I mean, Chris Kossman is LA local, the race director for this event, and he's been at the helm for around 15 years, I think. And he likes to know what makes you tick and why you're attracted to this event and what your motivation is for doing something like this. And I think that the people that end up there, the lion's share, really are trying to learn something about themselves and have an experience that will be memorable.
What was your motivation for the first race?
Well, I was running marathons in the early 2000s, and I had a goal to make it to the Boston Marathon. And once I achieved that goal, I was looking for something to stretch. And I heard about 100 Mile Mountain Racing, and I got into that and completed a couple of those. And this was sort of an event that was on my radar right from the beginning, and I had verbally said to my wife, I will never do that one. And then through a really poor night of judgment and a dumb bet with a buddy, we both applied for the race and both got invited the first time we applied. And then it was just a matter of seeing what I was capable of and what I could endure. And the prep for it was as difficult, if not more difficult, than the race itself.
Yeah, I can imagine. So how do you prep for, I mean, Death Valley? It's, as I said,
it's hot.
It's a warm day today.
<It's> toasty. Well, the main elements of training are getting your endurance running in, which for many people, you ask 10 people, you're going to get 10 different answers. But long runs on the weekend, that can consist of 4 to 6 hours, 2 days in a row. And, you know, I'm a trail runner by trade, so substituting a lot of my mountain running for hard pavement runs.
Because most of this is on asphalt.
It's all on asphalt.
Wow.
So learning, you know, teaching the body to kind of endure that impact is important. And then the second aspect of it is to prep for the heat. You get into a dry sauna, 180-degree sauna, and you condition your body over a series of weeks to process more fluid, to sweat more efficiently, to sweat less electrolyte, and your body sort of adapts to the heat. And it's pretty crazy because at some point 100 degrees feels like 70 and breezy.
Oh
my gosh. The body really does respond if you prep it in the right way.
Wow. All right. But I can imagine no prep really prepares you for the experience
No.
of running this race. Jimmy Dean Freeman, running coach and speaker and two-time Badwater finisher. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me on.
My pleasure. And that'll do it for us today. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.